It is Science Hour. Dr. Carl is in the studio. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning. How are you today, Dr. Gemma?
Very well. Fractured rib, but other than that, I'm fine.
Ah, how'd you do that?
Fell down some stairs, hit the railing.
Believe it or not, the Arnold Schwarzenegger action movies are not real. You cannot be picked up and thrown 30 metres through the air and bounce off a concrete wall and then just come up again.
No, you cannot.
It is so fragile. It's amazing how easy it is to break something and not even know you've broken it until later.
I know. It wasn't until the following day that I thought, oh, this is actually not very good.
So when you breathe in?
Yeah, I have to breathe in really deeply so I don't get pneumonia, even though it hurts to use all of the lungs.
So on one hand, you're going into antalgic breathing, mm-hmm. fancy word meaning ant against, algic pain.
Yes.
So you're breathing shallowly. But then if you breathe shallowly, you can then end up getting an infection in the lungs, pneumonia, old person's friend, you die, not the old person. So so you have to put up with the pain. Have you got a splint on it? Like have you got a
no
bandage?
No splints. Nope, just pain relief. But it's all good.
Pain relief is good. There is a limit to how many Panadols you can take a day.
There is. No, I've been all worded up on that. My GP is very good. But enough about me and my silly broken rib. We've got you in today to answer some science questions. If anyone's got a question, you can give us a call, 1300 055 36. If you've got answers, feel free to drop us a text, 0439 75 7555. And you can also tweet Dr. Carl at DOCTORKAR. Let's kick things off with Jeremy from Perth. Good morning, Jeremy.
G'day, doctors. How are you going?
Very well. Good. What's your question?
Just wondering if a fire in a steel office building can spread fast enough and heat the whole building to crumple into a mess like it did with the 9/11 Trade Tower.
It did with the 9/11 Trade Tower. So that definitely happened. So what's the specific question? I want to get the exact wording right so I can specifically answer.
Can it heat up fast enough everywhere over the whole building to collapse like it did?
Sure. If you add in 200 tons of kerosene as fuel, sure. A few bits of paper in waste paper bins? No. 200 tons of kerosene? Yeah.
What temperature does it have to be for steel to melt like that?
Don't know. It doesn't have to melt. It only has to get weak enough to lose its structural integrity. So it goes from being rigid to soft to liquid to gas. All it has to do is just get soft enough to lose its own structural integrity. For example, a column of steel 5 kilometres high will flow under its own weight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right.
Right. So
and
if you've got some
steel off everywhere across the whole, like the major columns, just spread the whole way through the building.
I don't know what you mean by the whole way. You mean from the 100th floor down to the 0th floor, or did you just mean on one level?
From the whole floor, all of the floors.
No, of course not. Like the fire can only affect the floor that it's on. Mm. And then once that floor collapses, then suddenly you've got the weight of the floors above. So we're talking about the 9/11 denialists who reckon that it was organised by the government as a false flag. Have you heard that phrase,
just
false flag?
Stuff on the net and wondering what you thought of it.
It's crap. So the thing is that if you go to any university and sit in about one third of the way through their Engineering 101 lectures, they explain exactly how it happened. And so the building is built strong enough to withstand normal use. But if you have the whole half of the building above it just going chunk, then it sets off a pressure wave and down she goes. Mm. So the weakness is only on one floor and that's enough to drop another 40 floors above it all down and then it just goes down like a pack of cards.
Few factors there, Jeremy. Hope that answered your question, though. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks. See ya.
Dusty from Orange is on the line. Hello, Dusty.
G'day, how you going?
Very well. How are you?
Good, thank you.
What's your question?
Okay, so my question is, right, if you're in a vehicle and you're going down a large hill, if you put it in neutral, say you're doing 80k an hour, you're knocking in neutral, and you rev the accelerator, it actually feels like you're slowing down, but there's no difference in the speedo.
Right. And how do you measure this slowing down? Just by what your sensors tell you?
Exactly right. Yeah, so the sensors, yeah. So you can be in an automatic or a manual, in a 4-cylinder or a 6-cylinder, and I haven't done it with a front-wheel drive car, but
In that case, it just proves how easily your sensors can be fooled.
Mm.
Why the pathway? I don't know. For example, with some of the European luxury cars, they go to a lot of trouble even to make sure that the sound of the door closing is
That's right.
Masculine enough to make you feel that it's shut properly, but not so much that it would scare a little child. And so with the exhaust systems, they tune them to have just the amount, right amount of oomph. So you can be fooled so easily by sound. I'll give you an example of an illusion, the moon bigger on the horizon. Mm. We don't know why. We know that it does look bigger. We don't know the pathway in the brain that it does it by.
There you go, Dusty. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Dusty.
See you later. Thank you. Bye. Heading to Frio now. Tim, how's the beach this morning?
Well, I wish I was there, but I'm not. I'm at work.
Oh, shame, shame.
Oh, Tim.
But you managed to get through. What's your question for Dr. Carr?
I just want to know why us as humans have evolved more rapidly than other animals. I definitely believe in evolution, but it's just odd that we've come so far and sheep have pretty much stayed the same.
We had the advantage of a big brain, but then so did the dinosaurs towards the end. Towards the end of the dinosaur reign, about 65 million years ago, there were dinosaurs that were about the size of a small adult with a brain around 300 cc's.
Okay.
And it didn't take much to go from 300 to 600 and then to 1200, 1300 like we have today. But they got cut short via a big lump of rock and other factors. With us, we have what's called evolutionary pressure. And so the numbers of humans gradually increased, but we didn't really have much going for us. Like our teeth, they're not like the teeth of a dog, which can rip your neck out. Our claws are just pathetic little fingernails. We can reach 45 kilometres per hour for about 1 second if you're Usain Bolt. What we can do is we can outrun another animal because we can sweat a lot, but we had this brain. And if we got ourselves together in groups, we could then say, okay, you go on that side, I'll go on this side, and we'll scare the animal and it'll run away from us and it doesn't know that there's a cliff. And then it'll go over the cliff and we'll go to the bottom. So there was an evolutionary pressure to get our brains to evolve bigger so that we could survive. Mind you, about 70,000 years ago, in the depths of an ice age, when the ice was 1 kilometre thick over Germany and New York, in Indonesia, Mount Toba, T-O-B-A, exploded 70,000 years ago. It turned Mount Toba into Lake Toba. It threw about 1,000 cubic kilometres of dust into the air and dropped the temperature of the world by between 2 and 4 centigrade degrees in the middle of an ice age, and the number of humans on the planet dropped down to 2,000.
Wow.
Half of them, male, half female. You and I are descended from one of those males. Gemma is descended from any one of a bunch of females, but all the males on the planet today came from just one of those guys. It's not as though one of the guys said, you guys go over there, build a fence, I'm going to check out all these things that I think are female, but rather there were a bunch of lines of males that started off and died out, and you and I come from just one. And the evolution that we've done along the way, well, in the last 12,000 years, 7,000 years ago in Hungary, the Europeans evolved to be able to drink milk while being an adult by having an enzyme called lactase. Two-thirds of the people on the planet haven't done that yet. We evolved, and also 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, three separate groups of Africans did that same lactase evolution as well. We've also evolved for blue eyes in the last couple of thousand years as well. Why? If we hadn't, we would have died out. Not because of the blue eyes, but we need to evolve our brains bigger.
Yes.
Interesting awesome. Stuff. Thanks so much for the call, Tim.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Have a good day.
Cheers, see ya.
Let's get another call going. Fiona from Maitland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question for Dr. Carr?
So my question is, I was told recently by two different consultants for a well-known kitchenware brand that their microwavable containers are made purple because microwaves don't heat purple.
How much money are they willing to put on that? Oh, mate. Microwaves have a wavelength of about the distance across your fist, about 10 centimetres, whereas light, purple light, has a wavelength of about half of a millionth of a metre. They're way off from each other. It could well be that what they've done is they've made a plastic that has zero water molecules and zero anything else that can absorb the radiation that has a wavelength of about 10 centimetres and therefore doesn't heat up. The purple is just an identifier. I would like to see that in writing. And then can you call us here at the station once you got that in writing. So what we wanted is on a brochure. I think that they've been educated beyond their knowledge on that one.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. But if you can get it in writing, we might think about sending you a Triple J fun pack, maybe.
Ooh,
maybe.
Fiona, if you can give us a call back with those details, that'd be awesome.
I will.
Awesome. Fax it through to the ancient fax machine or scan. Take a photograph with your phone and send it to us.
And text it in. That'll probably be best. Thanks for the call, Fiona. This is Science Hour on Triple J with Dr. Carl, 1300 055 36, if you've got a question for us. Let's get straight back into it. Michael from Crow's Nest is on the line. Good morning, Michael.
Dr. Michael, welcome.
Oh, Michael from Crow's Nest. Hello.
Yes, yes.
There you are.
Dr. Hi. Michael, welcome.
What's your question?
My question is, do radio frequencies have any magnetic properties?
Yeah. Now think about, you get a rope, right, and you tie the rope to a fence, maybe about 10 metres away, and then you move your hand up and down and you can see a wave going along the rope up and down. Have you got that mental image in your head?
Yep.
Now, imagine that there's another rope at right angles to it and it's got a wave going sideways. Mm-hmm. So that's your classic electromagnetic radiation. So we'll say that the electric field is going up and down, up and down, up and down, and the magnetic field is going left, right, so that is electromagnetic radiation propagating through space. So electromagnetic radiation has an electric component, electric field, and a magnetic field component. Yes, go on.
Okay, so if you were to tune into a radio station and then drive away from that radio station, you could maintain or hold that frequency for a greater distance as opposed to try to tune in from that greater distance to begin with.
Oh, okay. So if you're already locked in, can you hold it? Okay, that's different. Is this in a car?
Yeah, for instance, yeah.
Is it a modern car or an old car with an old bomb radio?
It's modern.
Okay, so the modern cars have had for the last 20 years, if that's modern, a thing called PLL or phase lock loop. So they find the peak of the frequency and then they lock in on that. But having got it, they've got a memory. The old radios didn't have that. So once they've locked in, they've got a memory of it. And if the signal just drops down, you go over a hill and it just drops down below detectable, it'll say, "I'm waiting. Come on." And then you drive up to the top of the hill and it finds it again. It's waiting, listening on that frequency. Whereas if you're out in the sticks and you go tuning through all of the frequencies, it'll bounce on that frequency, hold it for 1 second and say, "Nothing there, go on to the next one." So if you've already tuned in, you can hold that frequency for longer than if you're trying to pick it up while driving towards it.
Okay.
There you go, Michael. Thanks for the call.
No worries. Thank you.
Have a good day. David from Brisbane's on the line. Hello, David.
G'day. How's it going?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is for Dr. Carl. I've been waiting for this one for a while. I've even stopped the urges from Wikipedia or Googling it. I've been saving this one for you, Carl.
Oh, you are.
Now, US Navy vessels are going to employ lasers and or pulse cannons to their vessels very soon. I'd like to know, what are they talking about? What are we looking at here?
Going to? Let's just back up here. Did you read my 10th book called Bizarre Moments in Science back in 1991, or had you not even been born then?
I was a young fella.
Right.
I was learning to read.
Back then, they were already starting it.
Right.
Today, according to what I read in Aviation Week and Space Technology, otherwise known as Megadeth Weekly, from an article that I read about 6 months ago, from memory, every US Navy vessel has a 10-kilowatt laser. Okay, so the normal laser that you're allowed to buy, which won't harm the eye, is 1 milliwatt or less.
Yep.
The ones that the crazy people wave around the sky, 20 to 100 milliwatts, and they can burn out the eye. So you see the bright light and you shut your eye in response, but that's too slow. And in that time, you've got a blind spot in your vision. Really, really dumb.
Permanent.
I was at a gig, and a music gig, and they were doing a laser light show with a 4-watt laser. And I said, "Oh, how bright is 4 watts?" And the guy said, "Watch this." He pulled out a cigarette and put it into the beam and went just like that.
You're kidding. And those things are running at 10,000.
So the US, from memory, they have installed 10,000 watts, not 4 watts, which will go make a cigarette go immediately, but 10,000 watts.
Jeez. So that's a continuous laser? Like the beam itself I'm talking about. Like I'm a builder. I use lasers a lot. So is that a continuous beam?
I don't know.
They're going to try to saber the missiles, or will they be shooting short control bursts like on Star Wars and stuff?
Oh, that's more against people. So if a bunch of people are coming towards a ship with a whole bunch of high speed boats. Weaving around in the dark, trying to get close enough so they can have an explosive right next to the boat. What they'll do is just aim it at the people on the boat so they'll go blind. It will not cut. You need megawatts to cut through. Well, depending on if the target is moving, how thick it is, whether it's rotating, et cetera, et cetera. The Americans were for a while working on a flying laser inside an aeroplane. That was in my 17th book. You didn't read that one, Flying Lasers, Robofish and Cities of Slime.
Sorry.
No,
sorry.
That's okay. A reading to do, David.
I'm waiting for the TV series. Jeez, come on.
Looking, by the way, you can get it all for free on the ABC homepage. Go to the Dr. Carl section and look up Great Moments in Science, and there's decades of stories. So the 10 kilowatts are not enough to explode an incoming missile. You need you need the megawatts, but against the human beings, no worries at all.
Wow.
So that's lethal? It's not going to be used as a non-lethal. It can actually, is it skin irritation and blinding to put them, to deter them, or is it going to be a lethal dose?
Actually, I'll have to back up on that. If 4 watts is enough to blind, if 50 thousandths of a watt is enough to blind you, and 4 watts is going to actually burn your skin, I think 10 kilowatts will be enough to make a hole in, say, a boat.
Oh,
and then the thicker the metal, the longer it'll survive. I have to look up the article again. It's just in my memory bank. Sorry, I failed you on that one. My memory's not good enough.
Sounds like you're going to have a little bit more reading to do, David. That's opened up a bit of Pandora's box.
Okay, and by the way, Wikipedia is good, but the best part of Wikipedia are the references. Go to the references, then follow them down. And with regard to Google, go for Google Scholar.
Google Scholar.
Google Scholar.
Thanks for the call,
excellent.
David. Have
Thank
a good
you
day.
Very much,
Dr. David.
Let's head to Perth. Tyrone is on the line. Hello, Tyrone.
Hi, Dr. Tyrone.
Doctors.
Good morning. What's your question?
My question is, if you fill up a balloon full of flammable gas and you light it on fire, the fire only lasts for split second, but the sun is a ball of gas, and when it was lit, why did it not explode? Or
good point.
Where's the air to fuel it as well?
Very good questions. Okay. Firstly, there's two different types of burning. There's the one that you're familiar with, which is chemical burning. So you get some paper or some wood or some coal, and atoms get rearranged in molecules and energy is given off. So carbon plus oxygen gives you carbon dioxide, so atoms are being shuttled around the place. Chemical bonds are being made and broken, and you're getting the energy in that chemical bond. You're doing chemical burning.
Yeah.
What happens in the sun is nuclear burning. So do you remember back to high school and atoms?
Yeah.
They've got a central core with a whole bunch of electrons around. In chemical burning, all you're doing is fooling around with the electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a fair bit of energy if you go to high explosives, but you don't touch the center of the atom.
Uh-huh.
In atomic burning, you go into the center of the atom, and the amount of energy available is billions of times more. So the sun is doing a different reaction. It's not rearranging atoms. It's actually making new ones. So every second, the sun burns 620 million tons of hydrogen. But it's nuclear burning. And so hydrogen plus hydrogen gives you helium plus energy. So you've created a brand new element. You've done something with the center of the atom, and that 620 million tons of hydrogen gets turned into about 616 million tons of helium. There's a shortfall of 4 million tons. 1 million tons every second gets squirted out as charged particles and the like into the solar system as a solar wind. 3 million tons every second gets turned into energy via E equals MC squared. Nothing to do with oxygen. It's just nuclear burning, which is different from chemical burning. Look it up on our good friend Wikipedia and be prepared to be astonished.
There you go, Tyro. Thank you so much for the telephone call.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Catch you later. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Okay, my question for Dr. Carl was, is it true that when we die, our hair continues to grow? And if it is true, how is that possible?
Ah, where do you find this out?
I don't know where I've heard it. I think I've heard it in conversation somewhere before, but it's intrigued me.
It is very intriguing. No, it's not true. They lied to you. I know. What happens is that after you die, you dehydrate. water vapor comes out of the system, everything shrinks just a fraction, and the skin pulls back. The hair has already been manufactured by the hair follicles, 100,000 or so on your head, whatever it is on your chin, and more sparsely packed on your skin elsewhere else, apart from your chin. The skin pulls back, revealing the previously manufactured keratin hair shaft. Same with the fingernails. They don't keep. And by the way, your fingernails grow normally at about 1 millimeter per 7 to 10 days, depending on where and how old you are. It's kind of hard to think that somebody's going to say, wow, it's gone from 3 millimeters to 3.5. You know, that one I don't. But the hair, that's definitely observable. The fingernails just got added for fun. Don't know why.
Thanks, Dr. Carl.
Thanks, Martin. Have a good day.
All right, see ya.
Tim from Hobart. Hello, how are you?
Hi, good, thank you.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Okay, my question is, why does it hurt so much when you pluck out one nose hair at a time, but if you get all of your nose hairs waxed at once, it really doesn't hurt much at all?
How do you wax nose hairs? Like, I've seen the process on skin, and it seems slightly removed from medieval barbaristic torture, where you lay down a fabric which has wax, you add heat, it pours in it, then it grabs onto the hairs, and then you go, rip, and people cry, and then there's reddened flesh left behind, and they do it again and again. How do you do it? I can understand how you do it on a leg.
Okay.
How do you get it inside the nostrils?
Well, it's not a wax on a strip. So it's like the hot wax, and my wife just sort of puts it up with a, she's a beautician, just puts it up just sort of maybe half a centimetre around the inside of your nose and pulls out a little tab and lets it dry hard and then just grabs it and pulls it out.
Ah! Does it hurt?
No.
You're kidding?
No. It just feels like if you pulled on your nose with two fingers, it just hurts. That sort of, it feels like that. You can't, it doesn't feel like you've had 100 nose hairs pulled out at once.
But obviously, how many would be pulled out at a time? Would it be 5 or 10?
Oh, in my nose, probably 20.
At one, and then does it stop them from coming back again?
Yeah, for about a month or so, I guess.
Hmm.
Wow. Now, this is the reason that the you lose the hair on your skull and then it reappears in your nose and your ears as you get older as is not because of a previously undiscovered anatomical channel joining your scalp to your nose and ears, which I was able to convince my three-year-old daughter into for a little while. But rather, it's on one hand, from a philosophical point of view, yet another of God's little jokes.
Mm.
Number two, sheer envy on my part, not being as handsome as George Clooney as I get older, but rather fading away. And number three, changes in both the types of testosterone that you manufacture as you get older and the testosterone receptors. So it's not just as though there's a chemical called testosterone, there's a whole bunch. And these are involved with why you get more. I'm going to have to try this just to see if, are you sure it's real? It doesn't hurt.
Doesn't hurt.
But a singular hair does hurt.
It brings tears to your eye.
What does your wife, the beautician, say? She should try on a larger sample size of people?
Should they have clients that come in and do it? She does hers, mine, my brother, my mum.
There's lots of people on the text line right now saying that the nose wax is great.
It is great.
Why? Well, how does it work? Can somebody give us an answer? Now, on one hand,
we might have to do some experiments.
You'd normally expect that the people who would know, the experts who are the dermatologists, because hair is regarded as a skin appendage.
Mm.
However, hair in your ears and nose is not a medical emergency, right? It's a lifestyle emergency. So we don't know. Can somebody ring in with an answer or give us the answer on the Twitter page, DOCTORKRL, and the text number, Dr. Gemma?
0439 757 555. We'll see if we can get an answer for you, hey?
That'd be awesome.
Thanks, Tim. Have a good
day. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Jack from West Brizzy's on the line. Hey, Jack.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. What's your question?
All right. I was just wondering, so over the last few years, I've gotten a few tattoos, or a lot, like more than my mum would be happy with, I guess.
What is that number? Is it 1 or 5 or 10?
A sleeve.
More tattoo than skin.
Wow.
You've reached the 50% mark.
In just a year?
No. 2 years, 3 years.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
Well, anyways. All right. So how does it all, like, how does the ink, like, stay in your skin? Like, how is it, you know, like, permanently there? Like,
you know, why can't you just get a texture draw on your arm and, you know, that won't set?
Yeah, the way they used to do it in the old days, before they had the technologies of today, was simply to lay some kind of coloured ink upon your skin and then just bash it with a little needle, and some of it would inoculate or stay or remain in the epidermis. That would fade away. Epi means around or about, and the epidermis, the outer layer of the skin, would regenerate, and gradually the cells would carry the ink to the surface. At the bottom of the epidermis, the skin cells look like little columns, little trees, and then they gradually get flatter and flatter. So halfway up, they're sort of cubical, and by the time they get to the top, they're like a flat cobblestone, and they fall off, and then little creatures with legs that live on your skin eat them. And, of course, the big question is how many pairs of shoes they have. Getting back to the tattoos, they are permanent when they get into the dermis. So the dermis does not have a layer of cells that keep on heading towards the surface, gets sloughed off. So once they're in the dermis, they're there permanently. So that layer does not regenerate itself by going towards the surface. It's the epidermis that throws itself off. So once you get it into the epidermis, it's there forever, for better or for worse. That's where it is, in the epidermis. Sorry, it's in the dermis.
Dermis.
It's in the dermis.
So the needles are going deep enough down.
Yeah. So go to Wikipedia and just read up on dermis versus epidermis and you'll find the difference there.
Jack, you can think about that when you get your next tat.
Yeah, and the thing about the layer between the dermis and the epidermis is very weak in some ways, and so you can have an infection called cellulitis. So I've had 3 cases of cellulitis in my life. You know about cellulitis?
No.
So it's an odd name. What it means is an inflammation of that layer between the dermis and the epidermis, and once an infection gets in there, it can go like crazy. And I was working once as a car mechanic, and I remember it was a Mini Moke, and the drum brake had a sharp edge on it, and I cut myself on my thumb, and then the thumb started getting red, and then it started getting swollen and getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it started moving. And what happens is that you have 2 options, either amputation, or 3, amputation, death, or antibiotics. In 3 cases, my 3 cases of cellulitis, I went to see a medical doctor who then immediately gave me antibiotics and then told me to keep a close eye on it and to report back, and in each case the antibiotics knocked it off. Mm. Sometimes in hospital, when it's advanced, you draw a line, you give them the industrial grade antibiotics, which unfortunately have got side effects, but it's either that or amputation or death, and then you draw a line on their skin and then you write down the time.
And see how and then it swells.
And then you measure the diameter, you do the circumference of the leg, and you say what it is, normally leg or hand, and then you track it. And then if the antibiotics are working, you say hooray, and if not, you say we're going to amputate. And I believe that there was a case in the papers of somebody in one of the Australian refugee camps who died of cellulitis. Because once it takes off, it goes really fast.
Hope that doesn't happen to you, Jack.
Yeah,
have a good day.
Me neither.
Thank you so much for the call. Catch you later. On the line, we have Addis. Hello, Addis.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. And whereabouts are you calling from?
I'm actually calling from Janjuk, Victoria.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
How are you, Dr. Carl?
Very well, Dr. Addis.
What's your question?
A-double-D-A-S?
Yeah, that's it.
Short for?
A-double-D-I-S.
Is that a shortening of a Greek name or?
It's actually named after a beach near Bells Beach in Victoria.
Nice.
Addis.
Yeah, so I'm not too sure if my parents had sex down there or not.
Oh.
Or like they didn't call you left-hander slow-breaking Addis, they just called you Addis. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, okay.
Addis, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question today is, what triggers a dream when people sleep, and why do some nights we have them and some nights we don't?
We don't fully understand dreams. There's a wonderful magazine that you can buy on your newsstand called Scientific American Mind. And every now and then they do updates on dreams. Everybody dreams. And you do it 4 or 5 times a night. And what happens is you have 4 or 5 sleep cycles. So you're awake, you go deep, 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 come back up. And when you're in very light sleep, you're both paralyzed and have dreams. It lasts for 5, 10 minutes. Then you go down, up again 1.5 hours later. It happens again for a bit longer. Go down and up again for another 1.5 hours later. And you have a slightly longer one. We're always dreaming. We do not know why we dream. We do not understand why we dream, but we know that we do dream, and you are more likely to remember a dream if you wake up immediately after the dream.
Mm.
But the longer you wait, the more it just fades. So if you're remembering, it's probably on those nights where you're staying awake. There's almost certainly an application and some cheap device where you can track your dreaming during the night.
There you go, Addis.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Hope that helps. Thanks heaps for the call.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Benny, there.
Yeah, how are you?
Very well. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, why does urine sink?
Ah, is this when you're urinating down in a downhill direction towards the centre of the earth, or have you done it so that you've gone into the water and then while in the water urinate horizontally and then observe that it sinks?
No, I'm just, when I'm doing a urine into the toilet, it separates and sinks lower than the rest of the fresh water sort of thing in the toilet bowl.
Gotcha. The trouble is it's got high velocity. And so, just off the top of my head, urine should sink because it has more salts in it and therefore is denser than fresh water. Urine should not sink because it's at 37 degrees C and therefore less dense. So what we want is somebody to do the experiment by going into a freshwater environment where there's no movement, maybe a slowly moving river, and then urinating horizontally. And then seeing, so that way there's no up or down component, and then seeing whether it rises or falls. So you've got two factors, one to make it sink, one to make it fall. We'll have to, the trouble is that the downward motion, Ben, is too much to overcome. So it's not a good experiment. You're up to do the experiment, yeah. And then you could get a Triple J fun pack.
I'm just, my next question sort of is that I have noticed after coming back to the toilet, after not flushing it on purpose to see, that it's still separated lower than the level of the water.
Oh, okay. In that case, it's come to a thermal equilibrium. In other words, that's fancy talk for it's got the same temperature as what's around it. And the extra salts have made it more dense, like seawater is denser than fresh water. But the question is that when it comes out, which one wins, the hot to make it rise or the salts to make it sink?
If you want to do some more experiments, Ben, we will get you a prize pack and I'll be very interested to see
very
the data that you collect on that one. Thanks, Ben. Catch you later.
Thank you, Dr. Ben.
On the line, we have Nathan from Brizzy. How are you?
Good, thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I was just wondering about short-term memory and long-term memory. Like, what's the difference? Because I have, like, a pretty good long-term memory, but my short-term memory is, like, bad. Like, I'll drop my keys or put my phone down, and, like, within a minute, I'll forget where they've gone. But my long-term memory is, like, good. I can remember stuff from ages ago.
Yes, so they've laid down in different ways. In the recent issue of Focus magazine, I was astonished to find that little dendrites or spines are associated with memory on nerves. So think about a nerve cell. You've got this central body and then coming out of it is a long, skinny nerve to bring signals in the axons, and then coming out is another long, skinny thing to carry the signals to somewhere else called dendrites. On the dendrite are these little short, stubby cylinders, and they seem to be involved with memory. So there's short-term, medium, and long-term memory involving all sorts of chemical and physiological and mechanical processes in the body, and the way you can work with your memory is to train it. Here's a question for you. Do you know your own mobile phone number?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Many people do not. Right? Yep. So think about a muscle. You use it, you don't lose it. There are various books that you can go and look in the self-improvement section of your local local bookstore, which is a light against the darkness. Go and try them. And I met one guy who was worried about his memory, which was really bad. He got one of these books. He can now remember 50,000 places of pie. And in one of our Sleek Geeks ABC TV shows, we said, hi, this is Gemma. She has black hair and she likes a red car. Her favourite sport is tennis. And then we went through the whole lot. And then at the end, he got this information on every single person, on about 200 people. And at the end, we said, okay, who has a green car and likes to play golf? And he said, oh, that'd be Frank and Michael.
Wow.
And,
so you can do it. Think of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let him be your role model.
Just use those muscles.
Use those muscles.
Thanks for the call, Brendan.
Excellent. Thank you.
Bye. Let's see if we can get a really quick one in from Henry from Ballarat. Hello.
G'day.
Hello.
Henry.
What's your question?
We were just wondering if we happen to move into the ocean for some reason as humans, would we turn into fish in time? Somewhere in the middle there, like maybe a mermaid type situation?
Yes. We are in the unique situation where we can control our own evolution. We're not going to grow gills just by living in the ocean, but we're looking at periods of millions of years. But if you look at our Earth, it has the wrong name. The name of our planet is Earth. but 70% of the surface is water. Mm. I think a part of our evolution, we will genetically engineer ourselves so that we can live in that 70% of the earth that is ocean.
Short and sweet, Henry. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Henry.
Catch you later. Dr. Carl, it's been such a pleasure hanging out with you again. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And we'll catch you next week when you're back with Zan.